Good evening. Let's see if this works. It sounds as if it is working. Well, hello and welcome to all of you. I'm Kathleen Woodward, and as director of the Simpson Center for the Humanities, it is my great and good pleasure to welcome you all to this evening's lecture by Josh Ober from Stanford. He is giving our COTS Distinguished Lecturer for our spring quarter, and I'm very happy to say that he was nominated by Deborah Kamen, who was joined by a host of people, actually. So Deborah Kamen from our celebrated, superb Department of Classics, and other people along with her nominating Josh Ober include Carol Thomas from History and Jean Roberts from Philosophy, Jamie Meyerfeld, whom I saw there, exactly, from Political Science, and also Matt McGarrity from Communication. Many of you here know that the COTS lectures are in honor of Solomon COTS, in honor of his memory. He was a distinguished scholar of Byzantine history. Here he was admired as a university leader, serving as the chair of the Department of History, as the dean of our College of Arts and Sciences, and in many, many other capacities as well. I never knew him, but I'm told that he was beloved as well as admired, and that's quite an achievement. The purpose of the COTS lectures is to honor his memory and also to honor the work of extraordinary scholars and educators in the humanities, to stretch our imaginations and to, in fact, allow us to have platforms on which we can act creatively and with purpose. I want to offer thanks to Simpson Center SAP, who helped pull this week-long visit of Josh Ober into perfection with aplomb, and I want to thank especially Caroline Hansen, who I think has vanished to the outer reaches, but will be back. After Josh Ober's talk, there's going to be time for discussion and debate, if you will, and hard questions, if you will. But we're going to whisk him away at 8:30 for dinner. And so if there's more that you have and you'd like to engage, please do come to the Simpson Center in the Communication Building, 206. Tomorrow at 3:30, there will be a colloquium and time for more discussion. I want to make one announcement, which is that the executive board of the Simpson Center, there are 8 people serving on the board. The membership changes with some people rotating off every year, chooses someone to be the COTS Distinguished Lecturer from the University of Washington faculty, and I want to announce that next year, Stephen Hines, who is professor of classics here, the Lockwood Professor in the Humanities of Classics, and former chair of the department, and the recent recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities for his work in poetry across traditions, across languages, and the Latin tradition, those grants, those fellowships are exceedingly competitive. So I very, very much look forward to his talk and hope you'll all come for that. Actually, I need to make another announcement, which is, please, would you fill out this survey here and let us know how you heard about this particular lecture? That would be really, really helpful to us. Please fill it out. And then finally, I want to invite Deborah Kamen, who is also in our classics department here, as I mentioned earlier, an assistant professor, and whose book, Status in Classical Athens, is coming out from Princeton University Press, congratulations, who will introduce Josh Ober to all of you.
Okay. All right, thank you, Kathy. It is my great pleasure to introduce tonight's COTS lecturer, Professor Josh Ober. Professor Ober holds the Constantine Mitsotakis Chair in the School of Humanities and Sciences at Stanford University, where he is Professor of Classics and Political Science, as well as Professor of Philosophy by courtesy. He's also affiliated with Stanford's Center for the Study of Poverty and Inequality, the Center for Global Justice, and the Program on Urban Studies. As is perhaps evident from his multiple affiliations at Stanford, Professor Ober's work is truly interdisciplinary, encompassing not only classics and political science and philosophy, but also history, law, rhetoric, and sociology, among other fields. Much of Professor Ober's work has been on the theory and practice of democracy, both in the ancient world and today, with a particular focus recently on the relationship between dignity and democracy, and on the aggregation of knowledge in democratic societies. Professor Ober received his BA in history from the University of Minnesota and his PhD in history from the University of Michigan. He began his teaching career at Montana State University, then moved to Princeton, where he spent the next 16 years before arriving at Stanford in 2006. He is the author of many well-received books in the field of classics, especially in classical Athens, beginning with Fortress Attica, followed up by Mass and Elite in Democratic Athens, which is my personal favorite, and also the winner of the prestigious Goodwin Award of Merit, which is awarded annually to the best book in classics, followed up by a number of other books, including The Athenian Revolution, Political Dissent in Democratic Athens, Athenian Legacies, and most recently in 2008, Democracy and Knowledge, Innovation and Learning in Classical Athens. I won't even list the 10 or so books that he has co-edited or co-authored, but to give you a sense for the breadth of his scholarship, I'll just name two books, which I think show quite well how he applies lessons from the past to today. These include, among others, The Anatomy of Error, Ancient Military Disasters and Their Lessons for Modern Strategists with Barry Strauss, and also A Company of Citizens, What the World's First Democracy Teaches Leaders About Building Great Organizations with Brooke Manville. Now, in addition to this prodigious quantity of books, Professor Ober has also published over 65 scholarly articles and has been awarded scores of distinguished fellowships both nationally and internationally. There really are far too many to name. And I think it's important to note, finally, that in addition to this tremendous scholarly output, Professor Ober is remarkably kind, generous, and down-to-earth. I unfortunately, like Kathy, never had the privilege of knowing Saul Katz, but from what I've heard about him, Professor Ober is exactly the kind of person and scholar Saul would have loved. So this evening's talk is entitled, What is Democracy and What is It Good For? Please join me in welcoming Professor Josh Ober.
Well, thank you very much, Kathleen, Deb. It's really an honor and a privilege to be here. I've had the good luck to be able to visit UW a couple of times in the past, and I will say that back in the beginning of my career when I was in Montana, Seattle was my magnet city. So driving over the passes, despite the snow, despite all of it all, this was sort of a golden center for me. So it's wonderful to be back, and it's especially wonderful to be able to catch up with so many old friends and also to meet new ones. So what I'm going to be presenting this evening is in many ways kind of it's a new project for me. It's a topic, obviously, democracy, that I've been thinking about for a long time. And the general question of what democracy is good for is one that I've been worried about for a long time. But this particular iteration of what I'm doing is completely new. This is the first time out for this PowerPoint set of slides. So if it's a complete disaster, I apologize. But at least it's original. So everybody hates starting a class with a pop quiz. So I figured we may as well get the bad part over with quickly. Do we suppose that political theory is about evaluative, explanatory, or historical issues, or all of the above? You all remember, those of you who haven't been students for a while, you always go for all of the above, and of course that's right in this case. At least it's right if we're talking about the approach of ancient Greek political theorists, people like Thucydides or Plato or Aristotle, or early modern theorists, people like Hobbes or Locke or Rousseau. And it's true of the kind of non-ideal theory that I'm trying to develop. So if we think about classical, that is ancient Greek through early modern political theory, this is a kind of theory that conjoins moral reasoning, clarifying what we deserve and owe to one another, that is normative political theory, with a positive form of political theory that focuses on strategic reasoning, that attempts to explain problems, for example, of collective action and cooperation, and then historical reasoning, which is concerned with analyzing change over time, and then the kind of history I'm doing, especially change in norms and institutions and behavior over time. So I suppose that political theory of the sort I want to do needs to do all of these things all at once. Once again, I at least have good ancestors, although this is not, I should say, the standard approach to political theory in the 21st century. So the basic question of normative political theory in the 21st century is roughly this. How best ought choice-making moral agents order their or our polity, our community, in respect to authority and decision and judgment, to distribution of goods and bads, and in relationship to other collectivities, other states or other organizations? And what would it take to make these polities, these organizations, more just, and if we're concerned with democratic theory, more democratic? Okay, so those are all normative questions. These are ought questions. And we associate these with people like these. Now, if I was really going to continue on with this as a quiz, I would make you all be writing down who are these gentlemen, since they really are all going to be gentlemen that are going to be popping up from time to time. But probably most of you recognize Kant and Rawls, at least. And then part of the running joke it's meant to be of this lecture is that my colleagues keep on popping up. So the third one, for those of you who don't recognize Josh Cohen, is the guy who occupies the office next to me, another distinguished normative theorist. So if we think about positive political theory, then, the basic questions of positive political theory are like these. Why do individual agents choose as they do, make the choices that they do, and how do their choices result in a given polity, a given community, being ordered as it is and in respect to authority, decision, judgment, distribution, and other collectivities? And then what would it take, a positive theorist asks, to change that kind of order to make it more efficient, that is, to allow it to reliably deliver more goods to more people? Okay, so the basic idea then of positive theory has been pursued by people like the individuals that you see here, including some famous game theorists. This is John Nash, Thomas Schelling, and my colleague, Jim Fearon. So the point then is that these are meant to be similar. If you notice those two slides, a lot of the language is the same, and the idea is normative theory comes together with positive theory. Positive theory is often thought to be really difficult, right? Oh my God, it's really complicated and it's mathematical. And that's true if you do it as Jim Fearon and other really serious game theorists do it. But it does not require Nobel Prize level mathematical skills, Michael Choi has recently pointed out. This is a real book, I'm not kidding. This is Jane Austen, Game Theory. It's a really wonderful book. It's wonderful for people who like Austen. It's wonderful for people who like it. It can teach things to people who like Game Theory. And if you happen to like Game Theory and Jane Austen, you know, as I do, I mean, you're really in heaven. Normative, positive political theory, that is, bringing normative and together with positive political theory, is what I would call classical theory, right, because I think it's what my ancestors in this field do, are logically conjoined. They're parts of the same enterprise. Each seeks to understand choices made by agents and how those choices made by agents in communities lead to certain forms of social order that are more or less desirable. What's the wrong way? So the project of political theory, full stop, and therefore of democratic theory as part of political theory, is normative and positive together, so that political theory is, as I suppose, meant to be normative and positive political theory. So NPT is NPPT. That's my sort of slogan in this whole talk. And the point is, it's not supposed to be surprising. So I suppose that if you were to ask Machiavelli or Aristotle or Thucydides or Thomas Hobbes, does normative theory go together with positive theory, they would say what I have them saying. Normative and positive political theory uses history but rejects historicism. I think this is quite important, because historicism is one of the things that is one of the objections to a history by normative political theorists. By this I mean that history is meant to be used to expand the bounds of the possible, in the sense that if a given social order has existed, then it's not possible to sustain an argument that no such order is humanly possible, right? I don't need to explain that argument. This does not imply the historicist claim that if a given social order has never existed, it's ipso facto not humanly possible, no matter how desirable. Now, this is one definition of historicism. This isn't the kind of historicism that people who talk about new historicism and so on are involved in. This is the kind of historicism that this guy was concerned with, Karl Popper, who was very concerned with the kind of historicism that has not existed, can't ever exist. So the argument I'm going to offer is the first, that democracy is at the minimum a collective self-governance by an extensive and socially diverse body of citizens. So that's what is democracy. That's what it is. That's what you were interested in, and that's all you want. You can leave now. Sustainable democracy, basic democracy, I'll call it, requires rules and behaviors such that government is relatively stable, and such that there are limits on the powers of the government and of the government's agents. Basic democracy is not, at least so I claim, majoritarian tyranny, so it's wrong to define basic democracy as majoritarian tyranny. It is also not necessarily committed to universal human rights. So this is a kind of stripped-down form of democracy that hasn't yet become the full-formed liberal democracy that we're used to in modernity. So I'm trying to get an analytic conception of a kind of democracy that is sort of stripped of some of the features that we ordinarily associate it with it in the 21st century, but which are not part of the original definition. So democracy in this case is neither the antithesis of liberalism, which it would be if it is merely majoritarian tyranny, nor is it the fulfillment of liberalism, which it would be if it were necessarily committed to universal human rights. Basic democracy, so I want to claim, second part of the argument, if you're interested in what democracy is good for, it is good for human flourishing in the sense of living well and securely. In the first instance, must be capable of providing material conditions of decent existence, and then for fostering the free exercise of constitutive human capacities. I'll talk about constitutive capacities as we go along. and that preserves certain independently valued conditions of life, especially political liberty, political and legal equality, and civic dignity. Now, it's important to note that this kind of basic democracy may not provide all of these things equally for everyone. Citizens are likely to do relatively better. And furthermore, if the democracy cannot provide material conditions of decent existence, it's just irrelevant that it can provide the other two. If they're not in existence, then having free exercise is not going to be of much use for you, to you, nor is having these other valued conditions of life. So I'm going to say that you have to have the first, have to have basic conditions of life before we start worrying about these moral conditions. Okay, so what is democracy? How can I justify this argument that I've just given you sketched out? Well, until the 18th century, the model for democracy was the kind of government that existed in certain Greek city-states. The classic political theorists, the people who are writing up to the 18th century, knew about Greek democracy either from personal experience, if they were Thucydides or Aristotle or Plato, or from reading these guys, as well as a couple of other people, especially Polybius and Plutarch. So what is the model state if you care about democracy? Well, if you're Rousseau, you might have one opinion, but if you're everybody else, you pretty much have another opinion. And so the question we might ask then is, what is democracy? What was Greek democracy really? I mean, we know rather more about Greek democracy than these guys did. What was it? Well, demokratia, right, the original Greek word, obviously a compound of demos and kratos, people and power, a compound invented in Athens sometime around or in the aftermath of this revolution whereby the institutional form of democracy was brought into existence. Demos in this compound means, at least so I have argued in some detail elsewhere, and there's bibliography on the website you can go to if you don't believe this just when I say it. It means the whole of the citizen body, that citizen body both extensive and socially diverse. In Athens, all native males, that is rich and poor, socially diverse in that sense, rather than the many who are poor. That's the other way that demos could be used in Greek. In the original compound, for philological reasons, I think it can only be that it means the first, that it means demos as all. And kratos in this compound must, once again, for philological reasons, mean the capacity to do things, not rule as domination. And this, once again, is in the original meaning, not in the meaning that is used by democracy's critics. Already by the middle to late 5th century BC, critics are saying that demos is those others, those many poor people who dominate us, the worthy and relatively few wealthy gentlemen. So they're saying that democracy is majority tyranny. But in its original meaning, it was not that. It was the meaning was the people's capacity to do things. Okay. So this is then what we might call joint political action at scale if we were interested in philosophy of action, as various people have been, for instance, Philip Pettit, and some of you will recognize my colleague, Michael Broutman. So the original definition then was developed in terms that were both descriptive, that is, claiming that the people do have the capacity to do things, but also normative, that people ought to have that capacity, that people ought to be able to do things. And it was developed originally in the context of a particular kind of participatory democracy that had distinctive features, some of them unattractive. But the original core definition, I think, still captures the core of what basic democracy is, simply collective self-governance by citizens. Now, in the period after the Peloponnesian War, this original definition, just collective self-governance by citizens, of the people's capacity to do things, was changed a bit. New institutional rules were brought into place, which required that the citizen assembly, the people gathered in their public assembly, now had to conform to constitutional laws enacted and revised by bodies of citizens. And this post-Peloponnesian War augment to the original definition gives what I would call the mature Greek definition of basic democracy, and that is collective and limited self-governance by citizens. So limited in some sense that the people don't just do whatever they will as soon as they will it. It is limited by laws that the people set upon themselves as a kind of break on what they do, at least in the short term. So this new limitation excludes the alternative definition of democracy as majoritarian tyranny. In a sense, the institutional change changes the meaning of democracy in ways that respond to the challenge of the critics of democracy. They've said it's just majoritarian tyranny, and that, in a sense, that it could become just majoritarian tyranny was recognized by the Athenians. They changed the institutions, and they changed, ultimately, I think, the core meaning. The mature meaning, then, is limited. So we have three conditions for democracy, if you buy this, you know, story about the original meaning. So that in order to fit the definition, the basic democracy must be collective self-governance by citizens. That is, reasonably effective and stable over time. It's got to exist and be able to actually accomplish things. People must actually have the capacity, right? Not just ought to, but they do have the capacity. And it is limited somehow by law. So specifying rules and behaviors that simultaneously meet each of these conditions is not easy. Indeed, very notable democratic theorists have said that these three conditions cannot simultaneously be met. It's kind of a trilemma that you've got to, if you can have two of them, but not three. So Joseph Schumpeter argued that democracy cannot beat collective self-government, claiming that truly collective self-government cannot be achieved because of the impossibility of collective will formation and expression. So again, these are all sort of complex arguments that I'm just throwing out quickly. You can follow them up. Sheldon Wolin, joined by various contemporary democratic agonists, suggests that democracy in its proper, as he understands it, cannot be stably effective, claiming that as soon as the people start stabilizing rules, their collective capacity to do things disappear, says that democracy becomes a fugitive phenomenon. And then Benjamin Barber, following Rousseau, suggests that democracy cannot or must not be limited, claiming that to be real, democracy must be strong. What would the Greeks think about these? They just would say, I don't get it, you know? That's not a kind of, we mean by democracy. But each of these theorists have felt justified in appropriating this Greek term, right, democracy, for their own purposes, claiming that, after all, that original form simply can't exist. There might be perfectly reasonable arguments that a guy might make about why you would want to appropriate it. However, you might say, maybe we should test that claim. This is my colleague who is not quite as young as he looks in this picture anymore, Mike Toms, who is one of the great empiricists and also has theoretical interests. Okay, so can basic democracy, understood as collective and limited self-governance by citizens, reliably provide adequate levels of security and welfare for a complex human society? If it can't do that, the rest of it's not going to matter, right? So this is the first question we have to ask. And this guy, Thomas Hobbes, is pretty clear. Absolutely not. In Leviathan, one of the greatest works of political theory ever written, Hobbes argued that humans are by nature self-interested, proud, and dangerous to one another, and that without a third-party enforcer, Leviathan, humans cannot make credible mutual commitments to one another, at least at scale and over time, and therefore without Leviathan, human lives are famously doomed to be poor, solitary, nasty, brutish, and short. That's the end of it. Leviathan, or take the consequences. Hobbes was arguing for what we would today call positive political theory. Okay, he's basically making an argument about what is possible based on assumptions about the choices that human beings make, based on the assumption that they're acting reasonably, rationally, given what they know of their own capacities and those of other people. If you wish to live at all well, that is, outside the ghastly state of nature that he supposed would exist, you do not have an absolute sovereign. If you want to live at all well, there is simply no alternative to the authority of not only an absolute sovereign, but a lawless sovereign, a sovereign who is not under the law, that is, an absolute ruler, unconstrained by law or separation or balance of power. Civilization, says Hobbes, requires absolutism. End of story. The implication is that we cannot hope to live very well or securely, full stop, right? Because, after all, if you don't have a Leviathan, you live under the state of nature, which is ghastly, right? Nasty, blah, blah, blah. If you do, you can't be sure that your Leviathan isn't going to be, say, Caligula, right? That's part of the picture. Hobbes is very clear about this. However, it's only if we accept Leviathan that we can avoid the constant fear of imminent death that is our fate if we do not submit to an absolutist government. So that is what you have to do. Hobbes' premise that we cannot reasonably hope to have minimal security or welfare unless we accept a lawless third party is not a silly one. Right? I mean, there's a lot of very careful game theoretic analysis of Hobbes' argument, and it's not silly at all. It's hard to, in fact, argue your way out of the argument that this isn't a direct quote. The conclusion, absolutism, is the unique solution to social order. That is the only way to have stability and minimally decent conditions of life. Hobbes just says that. Once again, this is not a direct quote. How about democracy? Well, Hobbes says that democracy could fit the Leviathan requirement, although less well than a single monarch, if and only if the demos is completely unrestrained by law, and if and only if the will of the majority is absolute, therefore if and only if the democracy is the tyranny of the majority. Right. So where does Hobbes get this kind of conception of democracy? Well, pretty clearly he gets it from Thucydides. Did he know anything about Thucydides? Oh, yes, he did. He was the author of the first English translation of Thucydides, written well before Leviathan, his translation well before Leviathan. And I think it is very clear that Thucydides is the source of Hobbes' understanding of what real democracy, majoritarian tyranny, he says, is and how it works badly, he says, and unstably. Once again, don't trust me, read Kinch Hoekstra, who I think is the best person currently writing on Hobbes and Thucydides. Democracy has a problem, however, in that majoritarian tyranny fails, as it turns out, if you read the relevant parts, I think, of Thucydides, especially on the Civil War in Corcyra, fails to deliver the goods of living at all well or securely. And moreover, Hobbes sort of puts in a poison pill Real democracy that actually is stable and does deliver the goods turns out to be not democracy at all. It turns out to be the rule of one or the few. That is, democracy in name alone, but in fact the rule of only one man. This is from the frontispiece of a little blow-up of the frontispiece of Hobbes' translation of Thucydides. And you see down below the people of Athens, little and tiny and insignificant, guess who? Pericles looks rather like our friend Leviathan in the centerpiece, a two Leviathan, not, but at least in the kind of a scale. So is Hobbes right? Right. Was Hobbes right about democracy? Well, the evidence of history is not good for Hobbes, as it turns out. We now know, as Hobbes did not, that there are, in fact, examples of stable democracies that don't at least appear to take the strong form of majoritarian tyranny, both ancient, things that he didn't know about what happens to democracy after the Peloponnesian War, and modern, that do seem to enable citizens to live relatively well and relatively securely. And yet, Hobbes would say, I think, that the challenge goes unanswered. If we think of this challenge, if you think of Hobbes as really setting a challenge to political theory and saying it's either absolutism or nothing, basically you have to explain why do these things actually work. You know, aren't they really maybe majoritarian tyranny, or really maybe the rule of, you know, a tiny elite behind the, you know, so you have to explain, if you want to really answer Hobbes, the theory, as well as just saying, oh, well, there are some refutations in the empirical record as we now understand it. So Hobbes' challenge, I think, can be answered, and the conditions of democracy trilemma, you know, those three guys who say you can't have all three of those things, stable and collective and limited, can be solved. And I think we can say what democracy is good for if you will accept a few basic assumptions about the inherent and distinctive capacities of humans, about methodological individualism, interdependence as an imperative for cooperation, and about the mutability of the environment in which societies actually exist. So one of the things I'm going to try to do is sort of play Aristotle off against Hobbes, and one of the moves I want to make is, if Aristotle and Hobbes agree on something, that's a pretty reasonable premise for argument, right? I mean, because they're not really meant to. Hobbes is writing fundamentally against Aristotle. I mean, Aristotle's one of the targets of Hobbes' work. Okay, so the first assumption about inherited characteristics and distinctive capacities is based on these three features: sociability, that is, living in norm-structured groups of diverse individuals is hardwired, as Aristotle argues explicitly that it is, and even Hobbes kind of admits it is. Once again, this is some of Hoekstra's work about sociability in the state of nature. And yet, human groups are highly diverse in their form and their organization, which is both sort of a weird thing for both Aristotle and for Hobbes in various ways. Sociability is the first assumption about humans. Rationality, Hobbes and Aristotle are fully agreed on this one. Ordinary, adult, healthy humans use reason to pursue goods, and they recognize that capacity in others. That is, they are capable of acting strategically. Despite limits on rationality, a strategic calculation is a feature of human interaction. And finally, communication. Language use, various symbolic systems development is universal and pervasive, as both Hobbes and Aristotle recognized. So humans learn through communication, and learning reinforces and builds upon and potentially revises social norms. So this, if we buy this first assumption, okay, that these are things that are true about humans, right? Once again, Hobbes and Aristotle agree about these things, so we ought to as well. I mean, you don't have to accept that, but it's meant to sort of get us off of my just simply asserting it. So this gives us what democracy is good for in the first instance, and that is the free exercise of what are our constitutive capacities, the capacities that constitute us, define us as human. Now, the opportunity, goes the argument, that properly to exercise constitutive capacities is intrinsically good for the type of being that has those capacities. That's a very Aristotelian argument, and I think that it's a fairly plausible one. It is a good independent of the products of that exercise. Okay, so that argument can be, I think, unpacked fairly easily by thinking about a cat. So if you hang around cats a lot, which I have done for most of my life one way and another, you could think about this as dogs or horses or any other critters that you know anything about. Okay, so the idea is that for cats, pouncing is a constitutive capacity. That is, cats are capable of pouncing. For a cat possessing all other material goods, like food and shelter and being petted and all the things that cats like, but denied all opportunities to exercise the capacity to pounce, that cannot be said to be a fully happy, flourishing cat. So there is a happy, flourishing cat, and there is a not flourishing cat. So the idea is supposed to capture the intuition fairly quickly. I assume now that the not flourishing cat is just a sort of Photoshop thing. That's really not a cat being tortured, but I just hope that. I got it off the internet, as you probably guessed. Okay, so human flourishing, then, if we say that, reasoning and deliberating, using reason and speech together towards common ends, are distinctive and constitutive human capacities. These are indeed social capacities properly used, once again, an Aristotelian argument, to pro-social sorts of ends. And this is partly why, I suppose, that lying and cruelty and cheating, also capacities, right, are typically blamed, whereas use of reason and speech to promote social ends is praised. So it's not just that any old capacities humans have to have, but there are certain pro-social capacities. Because democracy just is, by the definition that I developed, the joint activities of citizens in the exercise of their constitutive capacities for reason and deliberation to pro-social ends, then democracy is inherently good for human flourishing. Not sufficient for human flourishing, at least in my account, but inherently good for human flourishing. That is what is collective self-governance by citizens using the basic capacities of reason and speech to common ends, that is, for doing things, right, for doing things in the world. So here we have a flourishing human, right, in the this famous Rockwell picture, and here we have, staged a non-flourishing human. And once again, it's just meant to capture the simple intuition that people who are using have the free exercise of the capacities of speech and reason together with other humans are doing rather better, all things considered, than people who are denied the use of their reason and speech towards common ends. Okay, so that's the capacities argument. The other three assumptions are kind of meant to get us to these other independently valued conditions. Methodological individualism, this is just meant to say that there's no hive mind among humans, right? Nice titles for books, but actually humans are individuals. Every human group is a composite consisting of diverse individuals, multiple minds, pluralistic identities, conflicting interests. Reason and deliberation allow for those conflicts to be negotiated, as they must be, right, if we accept our third assumption, that humans are interdependent, and this produces an imperative for cooperation. Without cooperation, we actually can't flourish. We're not very great doing the Robinson Crusoe thing, right, especially before Friday shows up, right? Even in Robinson Crusoe, you have to get this interdependence thing going. Interdependence intensifies under conditions of competition for scarce resources. I assume this is pretty common throughout human history. Competition within and between groups renders cooperation, both again within and between groups, necessary for welfare and produces a common interest in public goods. So once again, these are meant to be relatively non-controversial. And the third assumption of this group, is the mutable environment. That is, changes in the environment come about in various ways, through exogenous shock, like, you know, new group shows up in our world, uh-oh, here come the Mongols, you know, things are really changing in the world now, or endogenously, institution and norm development. And so the capacity to respond effectively to changes in the external environment is good for a group's competitive advantage and maximizes the benefits of cooperation. Once again, it's meant to be relatively banal claims. So if we accept these assumptions, B through D, then we assume that to meet Hobbes' challenge, that is to answer his challenging claim that only absolutism can bring us stability and welfare, citizens then in a democracy must use power as capacity rather than domination, right, in a positive sense of establishing rules and norms for the provision of public goods, thereby enabling diverse individuals to act as a community and to respond to change and identify common interests and settle conflicts, and also in a negative sense of using rules and norms to limit public bads, that is, limit behavior that would interfere with a community's capacity to respond to change and so on. Okay, so if we're going to answer this, we actually have to say that it's possible for citizens to use their capacity together. Certain conditions, I would argue, are necessary, are required for citizens if they are to collectively provide these public goods and collectively to limit these public bads in a mutable environment. Citizens must have liberty. That is, if their speech and reason is at the core of this, they have to have free speech and freedom of association. Diverse individuals have to be able to collectively employ reason and deliberation to discover and implement solutions. Right, they have a basic line equality because it's only when individuals have equal standing, equal say in decisions, that government can claim to be a truly collective enterprise, right? Otherwise, it's just a few people running things and ordering the rest. So it's not citizens collectively doing it unless there is some baseline equality. And finally, in order for liberty and equality to matter, individuals have to have high standing, not just equal standing, but equal high standing. That is, they have to have dignity to be functionally free and equal. In that, if you live without dignity, you live with humiliation and infantilization, and living within humiliation and infantilization means that freedom and equality really are not effectively, they don't effectively matter, that you can't make them operative. So I add an additional assumption to this, that these three conditions are and ought to be valued independently of their functional role in democracy. So the primary claim here is you can't get democracy without these three features. And then I'm just asserting, but you may not accept it, but probably I bet most of you do, that these are valuable things. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing to have a liberty, equality, and dignity. So these are all part of then answering what democracy is good for. Democracy, if this argument goes through, because it can't exist without these features. These are necessary conditions, therefore must sustain these conditions. Because democracy requires liberty, equality, and dignity to produce public goods and to limit public bads, democratic rules must be designed so as to preserve, at least for citizens, these independently valued conditions of existence. And then if we look back at our first good thing that democracy provides, first thing that democracy is good for, it is when people have liberty, equality, and dignity that they most freely and most publicly exercise their constitutive capacities of reason and speech. So these are meant to run together, right? These independent conditions and the constitutive capacities argument are meant to run together in answering the question, what is democracy, basic democracy, before we've added any features of liberalism from outside into it, basic democracy is good for then these things. Ah, yes, but Hobbes will demand to know, how can such a system be stable, right? Why doesn't it just fall apart for the reasons that Hobbes adduced in Leviathan? Why don't the powerful just do what they want, violate the dignity of the weak, undermine, therefore, liberty and equality, and crash the system, right? How can this system be in an equilibrium without a lawless third-party enforcer? So now I don't have a fully featured argument that I can at least offer in the amount of time I have, but I can give you a case study from Athens. And this is about how dignity sets limits on power. So dignity limits power, limits even the power to use to achieve things collectively. It is required because the functional effectiveness of liberty and equality demands dignity, and also dignity moderates between the demands of liberty and equality. I am not arguing that tonight, but I'm happy to talk about that argument in the Q&A. Since the dignity of all citizens must be protected, no democratic rule or public action by a democratic official or a powerful individual within a democracy can be allowed to infringe on dignity, and infringements without sanctions will crash the system, the democratic system, and therefore voluntary collective action in defense of law must take the place of Leviathan. That's the challenge. You know, that if that doesn't happen, then I don't have an answer to Hobbes. I don't have a way to explain why democracy might, but he's going to, of course, ask, it's all very fine and well to assert it, but how does it actually work? And this, then, is an argument that I've made in an article published a few months ago in American Political Science Review on democracy's dignity, in which I discuss various kinds of dignity, or a taxonomy of dignity. I'm most interested in citizen dignity. The standard form of dignity we tend to think about today is universal human dignity in the form famously developed by Kant. But I'm here concerned especially with the dignity that citizens can preserve for one another. And what I'm going to do is very quickly run through a very simple game. Okay, this is where positive theory comes into normative theory, and we're going to be trying to figure out why an individual, person number one, would end up in this upper right-hand thing where dignity is defended, or in fact even better down here where dignity is not challenged, rather than in this bad place where dignity is lost. We're going to assume that number one would actually prefer, if he could get away with it, to go there. He'd like to humiliate number two up here, and therefore he'd like to have number two's dignity lost. Why is that? Because he's like a Hobbesian, glory-loving, proud individual just likes to do that kind of thing. So we're assuming that there are such beings in the world. This kind of simple game theory made particularly popular by my colleague Barry Weingast. So we're going to think about the various preferences that number one and number two actually have. These are rank-ordered preferences. They're always the same for number one. Number one always prefers that dignity be lost because he's that kind of person. Second, always would, if he can't get that, would rather not challenge at all. He really doesn't want dignity to be defended. He doesn't want somebody coming in and punching him because he's threatened to punch somebody else, for example. Okay, so the point is that in these of regimes will get a different response by person number two, right? And we're really interested in this one, the civic dignity, where the what's going to happen is that person number two prefers that there be no challenge, but rather than dignity be lost, prefers to actually do what is necessary to defend dignity, and worse thinks a dignity loss is the worst thing. Why? Because number two is terribly altruistic? No, because number two doesn't want the same thing to happen to him. Okay, so he's meant to be rational. And so the result is going to be that person number one respects The second possibility is that there will be the outcome, the predicted outcome, is that there will be no challenge to dignity. So this is going to be what in game theory is called the equilibrium path. That's the one, if everybody acts rationally, that's where we'll end up. We will end up in a stable equilibrium, which is an answer to Hobbes in positive political theory terms, right? Civic dignity, what is civic dignity? Equal high standing among an extensive and socially diverse body of citizens. Remember, extensive and socially diverse was the definition of demos, which can be understood as a kind of a elite peerage grounded in political relations extended to a diverse set of persons and stabilized meritocracy. Once again, the argument about the elite peerage and meritocracy comes in this article. I'm happy to talk about it more afterwards. The point is that civic dignity is, I believe, typical of democracy, necessary for democracy, because it enables the mobilization of many citizens against those who would humiliate or infantilize others. So once again, here we are. The point is that number one comes up, and his desire is he sees number two, or he sees a third party that he wants to humiliate, and so he decides, aha, I think I will humiliate. Oh no! But now he looks down the game tree and he realizes that there's number two in existence. And number two actually prefers to defend dignity. Defending dignity is that's the least preferred thing for number one. So therefore, he's not going to get his most preferred outcome, that is dignity lost, because number two isn't going to go there. He's going to defend. And so therefore, number one has to take his second preferred outcome, that is no challenge to dignity, and that is Nash perfect, Nash subgame perfect. That's a stable equilibrium. Very simple for those of you who do game theory. This is the simplest form of the game, but it actually is. If we can make an argument that number two actually will reliably defend because of his preferences, that is going to be the stable outcome. Is it robust? Yes, because it is sustained by rational self-interests of each of the, as it were, citizens in maintaining the dignity of the citizens. It is defended by well-respected rules. That is, you know when dignity has been violated because the rules tell you that there's a bright line violation has happened. And it's sustained through habits. That is, we're used to doing this. We know what to do when there's a dignity violation. Defensive dignity becomes a collective responsibility of a clearly defined set of persons. Thus, citizens are those who are meant to defend the dignity of each other citizens. And democratic institutions, for example, law courts, provide mechanisms and incentives for public officials and for ordinary citizens to defend those whose dignity has been threatened. So this is a speech by Demosthenes, his speech number 21, defining what it is to live a life with dignity. And Demosthenes says at the end of this speech, in which he's talking about this nasty guy Midias, who loves to humiliate, lives to humiliate others, who Demosthenes is going to challenge in court and says, you know, this is, I'm the guy who's going to stop it, and says, consider in a moment when the court adjourns, each of you will go away home, not wondering whether it'll be someone friendly or someone unfriendly who will meet you on the way, or if you will be big or small, or strong or weak, or anything of the sort. And why is that? Because in his heart, each citizen knows and is sure and has put his trust in the Constitution that no one will take hold of him or be insolent to him or hit him. And basically he's saying that it is because we have this democratic institution, this Constitution, these set of institutions, that each of you goes about your life secure in your dignity. You don't have to worry about nasty number one because all the other number twos are going to come and support you. But will they really do that? Is it just the law that does this? What is it that gives power and control over everything in the community to those of you who are jurors? The reason that you have control over everything is not that you alone are the citizens are armed and mobilized in ranks. You're not physically the best and the strongest. You're not the youngest in age. Nothing like that. Rather, you'd find, if you investigate, that you are powerful through the laws. Right? Okay, there it is, the institutions. And what is the power of the laws? Is it that if any of you is attacked and gives a shout, the laws will come up and give you aid? No, they're just inscribed letters. They can do nothing like that. Then what is their motive power? Well, you are citizens, right? If you secure them and make them authoritative when anyone asks for aid, right? So the laws are powerful through you, and you through the laws. You must stand up for the laws just the same way as any individual would stand up for himself if attacked. You must take the view that offenses against the law are common concerns. Well, that's it. You know, that is the bright line institutions give you the right way to be a number two responding to the offense of number one. How about Demosthenes' own role? Demosthenes calls attention to his choices in this speech in bringing Midias to trial, and he emphasizes his own courage, the risks that he, as a voluntary prosecutor, because there weren't public prosecutors in Athens, had taken. Demosthenes is clear about his own hope for public honors as a result of his action, his public-spirited action in bringing Midias to trial. And this gets us to something I'm not going to work through. This is just a next step in game theory. But the simple point is we have number one again, and he has the same desire to end up down here where dignity is lost. And we have number two that once again is going to have his same capacity to do things. But there's going to be a number three, and number three this time is going to be the jury. This is going to be the demos that is going to choose ultimately, you know, how to react, either to acquit or convict, or if they various things, other things happen, to do other things. And the whole argument is, once again, I'll just assert it this time, this is Nash perfect, Nash subgame perfect. This is an equilibrium situation. If I have correctly described the way in which the prosecutor and the jury works into the Athenian system, this is an explanation of why the Athenian system is in fact stable even without Leviathan, right? And once again, this is all published, so you can work through it in detail if you like. Dignity beyond the citizens. Demosthenes claims also in this speech that Athenian law protected any person, either a child or a woman, or a man or a woman or a man, free or slave, against intentional disrespect, against indignity, or other lawful treatment. Well, whether this is actually true in practice or not, but at least he's stating this, and says that the Athenians do not think it right to treat with disrespect even the slaves whom they acquire by paying a price for them, but they have publicly made this law against disrespecting, against humiliation to prevent it. Once again, we don't know exactly how this plays out in practice, but it was possible to assert this in an Athenian court of law before a body of citizens. And furthermore, if we look at 100 years earlier, the so-called old oligarch giving a kind of blue guide or rough guide, I guess, to Athens, to his fellow elites, says, when you go there, don't go hitting slaves. You can do that at home, it's fine, it's fun, we all enjoy it. He doesn't say that, but that's kind of the subtext, I think. He says you can't hit slaves, can't hit foreigners, and furthermore, the slaves won't even give deference to you. Once again, true, not true, at least he's saying this, he's asserting this. And he says that's because Athenian citizens can't be distinguished from slaves or foreigners. And if powerful men were allowed to strike slaves or foreigners, they might mistakenly strike an Athenian citizen, says the old oligarch, this anonymous author. And therefore, to secure their own security, the Athenian citizens passed laws forbidding mistreatment of slaves and foreigners. Once again, we don't know what the actual motivation of the Athenians are like, but here is somebody trying to figure it out. And he actually is describing a world in which there is relative to other Greek city-states, anyway, less public humiliation of those who are not citizens than would be the norm in other more so overtly elite peerage type societies. So conclusion, basic democracy, this is the, as I've been defining it, is collective and limited self-governance by citizens. It is not majority tyranny. We don't have to we don't have to create majority tyranny as a necessary condition to assume that democracy could exist. Democracy enables citizens to provide public goods of security and welfare, that is material goods. It actually has ways to do this. Democracy stably promotes the free exercise of constitutive human capacities of reason and speech, some sort of a moral good if you accept the basic Aristotelian argument that this actually is good for you as the kind of being you are, to exercise the capacities that are constitutive of the kind of being you are. And because democratic rules offer citizens incentives for action, it sustains civic dignity, thereby functionally enabling liberty and equality, which are also moral goods. So the argument is, if we pair off this image, very idealizing image of Democratia, the goddess democracy, crowning a personification of Deimos, so this being Athens, we pair it up off of the Leviathan as the alternative. As it turns out, we don't need to do Leviathan, and that's it. Thank you.
What I'm going to do is ask you this.